Welcome, everyone, to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello there, Pete.
What up, everybody?
Pete, today we're dropping this special episode on both the Pop Culture Podcast feed and the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast feed. Today is, of course, June 6th, 2014. That is the date that the Clark Gregg film, Trust Me, has hit theaters. We both have seen it, and we want to talk about it.
Absolutely. Well, I've seen it three times, you know, but as you pointed out, the workhouse print notwithstanding, once on video on demand and then now in the theater. And we're going to break it down a little bit for you here.
Pete, I guess as we jump in, I'm sure not everyone listening has yet seen the film, or they might even plan to see the film. Maybe they don't know enough about it. Can you give us a little background on Trust Me?
Absolutely. Trust Me is writer, director, actor Clark Gregg's
producer.
Producer as well, I'm sure. Is his story of a lovable loser, child star agent in Hollywood named Howard Hollowell, who, through a series of misadventures, winds up discovering a diamond in the rough in Lydia, played by newcomer Saxon Charbino here. And throughout its 90-minute running time, runs up against people like his nemesis, poaching agent Aldo, played by Sam Rockwell, also a veteran of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, as well as a number of you know, notable and attractive ladies, from Amanda Peet to Allison Janney to Felicity Huffman to Molly Shannon, even Niecy Nash. Some supporting help from William H. Macy and Paul Sparks, who I didn't even recognize, was one of my favorite character actors from Boardwalk Empire, played the alcoholic father of Lydia. But all told, a fun yet deeper than I think we both anticipated, ambitious and uncompromising vision here by the second time writer-director. Clark Gregg, of course, had a co-writing credit on the Robert Zemeckis Hitchcockian horror homage, say that three times fast, What Lies Beneath.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with you that it was not what I expected going in. We all know kind of the dangers of, you know, trusting a preview. And it's not to say that I was disappointed by the fact it was different than what I think the preview had sold me on. But it definitely was, it was an interesting and unique view of Hollywood, I suppose. It essentially is a movie about Hollywood in a grand tradition of many other films that have tackled, you know, the seedy side of Tinseltown.
Definitely. And, you know, let's be upfront as to why we're viewing, talking about this film. You know, again, podcasting Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. As we do, and, you know, having the tremendous honor earlier this year to have interviewed Clark Gregg on our podcast. You know, it was something that was on our radar even before that. And, you know, he is the guy that brought us both to that TV show. So interesting always to see somebody in another role and to see, you know, explicitly with the Bluetooth headset hanging out of the ear, you know, you just change the setting and he's Agent Coulson. So I thought that was a very interesting motif there. And to have it broken again with the, you know, the lovable loser aspect is the differentiation. But I was really like hung up on that. Like, you know, you throw a fireball whizzing past that car and he's Agent Coulson.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, Pete, as a way of differentiating how we'll be addressing the film here, first we're going to kind of tackle the story. Then we're going to talk about the production aspects of it, you know, casting and cinematography and that sort of thing. And then we'll get into the different ways you can see this movie and kind of how we can all get into that headspace in terms of you know, that whole aspect of, is that the future of how we're going to be seeing movies and whatnot. So, Pete, where should we start officially as we kind of break down the story of Trust Me?
Well, I think it's always good to begin in the beginning, and we'll do that with Becoming. So we have a very dark starting point to this film. As I mentioned before, I was not prepared for that, again, given the tone I thought we were coming into, but that's okay, and that's welcome. You know, but Howard has been shot, and we get the voiceover, you know, about becoming something else and everything there. And what really struck me in retrospect, having watched the entire film a couple times now and looking for it on repeated viewings, was the whole idea of metamorphosis. Early on, we get the butterfly. Matt, did you notice what the play that he went, that Howard went talent scouting along with Amanda Peet's character, Marcy, and her son, to see, who was it? Pierce Brosnan's kid, right?
Pierce Brosnan's kid who can't act, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a stage version of Kafka's Metamorphosis, so certainly, you know, the notion that that there's a beast among us who can't quite recognize himself as such, or who are the beasts? You know, that is, of course, the thesis of Kafka's work. You know, the one guy looks like a bug, but everybody else is actually awful.
Right. And, you know, Samson Gregor and his transformation at the beginning, you know, of that story, okay, that immediately resonates, again, on retrospect. And smartly written, thematically, formulaically, certainly wise to do that. You know, we see the butterfly a couple times later in a darker portion. There's a little boy wearing wings, which you don't really associate boys and running around, you know, playing. I don't know about you, Matt. I certainly didn't don a pair of wings and run around the backyard. Not that I didn't imagine being able to fly or attempting to fly, but yeah, never did that.
Yeah, I had the red cape with the yellow S. Never quite took off, but certainly tried to.
On a story level here, I know we both brought some comparisons coming in ahead of time. And, you know, you're thinking genre based on a trailer, based on a description, etc. You know, I thought this was going to be Clark Gregg's take on Hollywood with a kind of Dickie Roberts, former child star, and maybe even a little Life with Mikey. Matt, what kind of baggage did you bring in?
Well, as the movie quickly became quickly revealed itself to be discussing, you know, the truth question mark of Hollywood or the darker side of Hollywood, that sort of thing, I immediately had a couple movies come to mind. Of course, kind of the overarching one, Sunset Boulevard, that really shows, you know, Hollywood will spit you up and stop caring. But a bit more prominent in my mind were two films. First was The Player with Tim Robbins, where he plays a very seedy executive, and it kind of shows the fake smiles of Hollywood in every degree. Ironically, The Player imagines, however, a Hollywood without any agents. That's kind of the big skewer there in this Robert Altman film. No agents. So, of course, here we have the very opposite. And then the other film was Swimming with Sharks, which starred Kevin Spacey and Frank Whaley, the latter of fame from Pulp Fiction and the whole, you know, Say It Again scene. In Swimming with Sharks, Spacey is just an awful, awful Hollywood executive. You know, the meanest man you could possibly imagine. Frank Whaley plays his assistant, and he finally gets pushed a tad too far. And by a tad, I mean a lot. So three films that basically say Hollywood is not a nice place, despite the fact that you love the product that comes out of there. And Pete, we have in Trust Me, a movie that I think reaches a similar conclusion that Hollywood is not a nice place.
From the idea of an agent for children who is, of course, played by, who was, of course, a child star himself. And early on, we get him, we know he's talking to a child actor, but there's the reveal when the boy steps out. And then, you know, the inciting incident where he hears Lydia's audition in the other room and the expository, you know, hook of, wow, that was really good. I believed it. And knowing that she is this ingenue who can step into this becoming Twilight, Hunger Games-esque mashup, YA, as they say in the trades, young adult series franchise role, you know, then it's just a question of ticking off, okay, Q losing the client, Q finding that this girl needs an agent. Let's roll out the Rockwell rivalry scenes, all that. You know, it's familiar yet fresh territory. It's funny. It moves. It's got some pep.
Yeah, there's Pete. Pep is a good word because there's a lot of facets to this story. You have the relationship that that Howard has with his neighbor, played by Amanda Peet, kind of. You know, she clearly is in the start of the film done with politely rebuffing him, although she's happy to politely rebuff him one more time. But he does start to make inroads with her. Now, Pete, something I found interesting was she started to like him more the more successful he became. And with that success, of course, is coming 10% of this 3-picture deal. So even in there, and it's not something that the movie, I think, explored particularly deeply, but even in there, it kind of was like, hey, she's finding value in him because he's successful in his job and more successful financially, you know.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I found that one of the more pure and wholesome parts of the film was, you know, their relationship. I didn't really pick up on a angle where she was using him, but you know, I'm not always quick to pick up on such things.
Well, I'm certainly not trying to suggest that the film was inserting that into the narrative. I'm just kind of wondering if, or that it necessarily was something that Amanda Peet put into her character, that Clark Gregg asked for in direction and writing and whatnot. I'm just kind of not looking at Amanda Peet as an actress playing this character. I'm looking at her character as a person and wondering what's going on in the story in her head. Again, kind of under the umbrella of what I took away from the film, which was that Hollywood is a dark place. Hollywood is a place that to find true and honest connections with people, that's something incredibly difficult to come by. Because as I go through it on the top of my head, I can't think of any two people, perhaps with the exception of the Clark Gregg character and the Amanda Peet character, any two characters who had a genuine, honest connection.
I mean, the whole down on your luck aspect, and there's really, you know, two storylines to that really get interwoven. There's Howard with his clients, you know, he loses the little boy, quick, cute cameo gets shut down by a little girl named Charlotte who throws on the headphones there. That was actually Stella Gregg. So hopefully that's not something she's done to Dad in real life and tuned him out there.
That's a good catch, Pete. I didn't know that that's who that was.
I'm sorry, Matt. I didn't hear you.
Are you putting your headphones on, Pete?
You caught me.
All the better than to, I'm sure she's a lovely young lady and very respectful and all that, but all the more reason to have, you know, snooty child star who, you know, ignores Howard be, you know, the daughter of Clark Gregg having a moment of, you know, I'm not listening, Dad.
But the unlucky in love, you know, interwoven plot. You know, it was cute. I was wondering where it was going. And in light of the completed whole, you know, it's certainly something to consider. The rapport that Howard, of course, develops with Lydia quite rapidly. The whole vampire wings, you know, idea that goes on there. And actually, Matt, looking at the whole again a couple times here in retrospect, I see a lot of another Sam Rockwell movie. I see a lot of Matchstick Men in this.
Oh, I've not seen it. Tell me about the connection.
Matchstick Men is a again a Sam Rockwell, Nicolas Cage film about grifters, about the confidence men, Matt.
Ah.
And there is a young teen character who, you know, central to much of the plot and in those types of schemes. And, you know, with the ultimate reveal here at the end that, you know, Lydia was playing a game. I felt a lot of that in there. And again, that's not to cast aspersion on Clark Gregg as a writer or, you know, a director at all. You know, these storylines, you know, can certainly reemerge. But it certainly felt evocative of it. And having Rockwell in the picture, they reinforced that for me.
He was a good addition, too. That character of Aldo, it was difficult to hate him completely. He was just motivated by being the best guy he could be. I don't want to say everybody's out trying to steal each other's clients, but, you know, everybody's just trying to get a leg up, as you are in any competitive business. There's a limited amount of A-level, B-level talent out there. These are kid actors, so there's kind of the understanding of you're probably not going to be representing them for more than, you know, 3, 5, 7 years, something like that. So let's all get going here. And if there's the opportunity to, as Howard says at one point, you know, they're just trying to get the best deal. This could be your one shot, and you do these three movies and you're done with. That could be your career. So let's get the best deal possible. That's what Aldo, on a large level, I think, is fighting for as well. And we don't deeply fault him for that. He's not a villain. He's just opposite our hero, Pete.
Yes. And, you know, where the movie needs to go from a standpoint of verisimilitude to give us the agent talk. And it is at the same time, you know, again, expository enough to be legitimate. At the same time, it's not too inside baseball, which I thought was very helpful.
You know, that's an excellent point, that we're all very clear on what the agent does and kind of the power structures. You don't need to spell out who everybody is and what their jobs are, you know, the Felicity Huffman character and whatnot. It's just kind of laid out in a very accessible manner. That's a really nice catch, Pete. I hadn't thought of that.
The place the movie does go that I both think was unexpected and I think we were a little wary was the predatory aspect. There really is twofold. There's the agent aspect of it. You know, these young men fawning over, you know, an ingenue for her talent, of course. And then there's the possible criminal edge.
Yeah, when it was first initially introduced, when Howard walks into the motel room and Lydia's there crying and there's the ever more clear implication of what he believes has gone on. At that particular moment in the story, I felt that it was a little too on the nose, just in terms of here we've introduced another conflict to it. It didn't feel 100% authentic. In retrospect, I think that was a bit of a credit to the story. The fact that it was 90% authentic, but not 100%, because at the end of the day, the truth in her abuse from her father is in that 10%, which is to say it is not real. It gets revealed that that's the case, that she's, as we've seen before, she's just taken other aspects of her life to be true, you know, abusive aspects and weaved it into a character for her own purposes of advancement in her profession, but obviously with you know, tremendously hurtful consequences.
I think we got a little bit of a taste of that in the diner scene where she acts, you know, that she's been hurt. And we don't know what to make of it then even. And of course the manager of the diner is concerned enough, and, you know, Howard, having been an actor, knows what he's dealing with. I think for him, it becomes far more gray, when he visits the hotel room. But, you know, to round this part of the story into, you know, we'll end on a cute note as opposed to the darkest of darks that the film goes to. There was a pretty realistic, from what I gather, script courier scene. So there's the excitement that Lydia is going to get to read this script that nobody has, et cetera, et cetera. And in our interview with Clark Gregg, he brought up the links that Marvel goes to with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and with their Marvel Cinematic Universe movies.
The last four or five scripts, we get them. And everyone, I realize that other people have gotten the script because I'm shooting when my phone blows up with the other cast members texting each other about the reveals. They've had the top secret red pages, and we, you know, everyone thinks they've read the script, and then we have special pages that come in at the last minute before we gather to do the table read in this room, and everyone finds out some huge new development about who really this character really is. And it's just, as a fan of that stuff, I love it.
Pete, at the end of the clip there, he's mentioning his great joy for finally being able to open that script to find the secrets that have been answered, to you know, uncover those written truths in the story. And I think that we see a slightly different version of that, but the same kind of venue in Trust Me, where it's, I mean, he's literally holding this next blockbuster, the next, you know, the next great, you know, a reference is made at some point. These are like the Harry Potter movies, or that's the hope. So there he is holding one of the very, very few, and kind of life imitating art, imitating life, imitating art.
And to bring it full circle with the way that the film ends, and Matt, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, you've name checked Sunset Boulevard already. I got a distinct film noir-esque feeling, even from the soundtrack there at the end, you know, that, you know, just that kind of trumpety, bluesy, jazzy thing to it, you know, as really the character dies at the end. I don't think there's another way to take the unfurling of the wings. So it's a broken dream.
That's a really interesting take, that this is some kind of, you know, noir nouveau view of Hollywood, where it's not the detective uncovering the things that we don't know about the secret plot. It's, you know, it's tromping up and down this very familiar world of Hollywood. And we know it's not all it's cracked up to be. And, you know, we see, you know, references made in the film to the Lohans and all that, you know. We all see kind of the TMZ side as well as the red carpet side, you know, we watching from afar type thing. The fact that this is kind of this interesting new take on noir, you know, where it's not the detective, it's the guy who's been in town all along, who knows all the ins and outs, but you know, it's a very fun story. It's a very unique story. And that's what I like best about it. It's a fresh take here from Clark Gregg, story-wise. With that, Pete, should we move on to production aspects of the film?
Definitely.
Pete, I think one area you have to talk about is the casting. I mean, this is just a deliciously cast film. Felicity Huffman, Allison Janney, Bill Macy. You know, the list just goes on and on in terms of familiar faces. Molly Shannon, I thought, was just pitch perfect as the stage mom slash manager slash, you know, she cares for her kid, but this is also like a business arrangement. She fires Howard to improve the vocation that she and her child have. I mean, again, we kind of feel bad for him, but, you got to do what you got to do to put, you know, bread on the table and whatnot. But in terms of casting Pete, just this endless bench of wonderful actors.
You don't normally see the bench this deep in a movie like this. And when I say a movie like this, again, please understand that's in no way disparaging. You know, this is a movie that hit on demand first, and now you can go watch in a theater, and it's been making the rounds at film festivals, which ordinarily are, you know, decidedly, you know, not as star laden as this. You know, Sam Rockwell is a leading man. William H. Macy is a leading man. You know, so to have them in there, that's big. And, you know, Amanda Peet has been a co-star in many a film. And, you know, a lot of wonderful, both comedic and character actors peppered throughout.
There really are. And I look ahead to saying, you know, what will Clark Gregg do next? I know there's been speculation about Marvel movies, and I'm personally not concerned about that at the given time. I'm wondering what Clark Gregg, the artist, is next interested in. What will his next script be? And if this is the cast that he can put together for a movie that I don't think it's derogatory to say, you know, was a movie made on, you know, probably a very small fraction of a Marvel movie budget. But if this is the talent that he can attract, what's next?
Well, Matt, I'm not uncomfortable at all saying, you know, between writing and directing this film himself and the places he goes on the page and on the screen, and that he got into writing something where there is a special effects aspect, he's managing a lot of talent. I'm not uncomfortable at all believing that this is in some way an audition reel to get into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, probably not from the TV angle. In fact, in our interview with Clark Gregg earlier this year, Matt, you brought this up.
In addition to being an actor, you're also a writer and a director. And then, of course, there are other actors who've used TV to get into the director's chair, like Jonathan Frakes, who had directed an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. episode this season. Do you think that we're ever going to see you directing a S.H.I.E.L.D. episode or maybe even directing a Marvel movie?
But I would love to at some point. They certainly have a magnificent way of taking care of directors who haven't done a lot of big visual effects movies. This independent film that I made called Trust Me that's coming out in May actually had some visual effects, and I found I really enjoyed playing with them and making that a part of the story. I'm sure at some point I'm going to beg them to let me direct the Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but it's so demanding just to pull off my work as an actor in that show. So far, I just can't conceive of it.
So Pete, there professing his interest for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., perhaps the Marvel Universe as a whole, professing his interest in focusing on the acting aspect, the craft of acting. Obviously, you know, no one wants to seem inappropriately ambitious, but I'm increasingly of the point of view that you've put forth here that Trust Me is a movie, among other things, that deals with complex twists and turns in the script, visual effects, as you mentioned, a variety of actors, acting choices, you know, personalities off the set, all that, you know, stuff. And he's working with it. He's putting it all together in Trust Me. Maybe that's the audition, a la Jonathan Frakes, who you know had tried out with a couple of Star Trek episodes before getting those Star Trek movies. Maybe this is sort of a similar case.
You know, I think they're wise too with the way it's filmed and the locations they use. You know, generic at the same time familiar. You know, offices, parking garages, restaurants, there's the apartment complex, the alley, Grumman's Chinese Theater. You know, these are recognizable places. You know, the amount of time I'm sure that they had to shoot, I would love to know the production schedule over which this took place. But, you know, he shows he can handle it. And I really don't think there was any doubt that he could. You know, doing Chuck Palahniuk's Choke you know, a half dozen years ago, he showed himself more than able to be able to handle what was a pretty big literary success. And now, you know, I think a more dark comedy than comedy that's dark, you know what I mean? You know, Clark has shown some serious chops here.
Pete, lightning has struck my brain when you mentioned Grauman's Chinese Theater. As they first drive up to it, there's briefly you could see that there's a poster for the first Hobbit movie, which was released December 2012. I can only assume that's when at least those scenes were filmed. So we're probably talking late 2012, early 2013 was when they were shooting the movie.
Good pickup.
And this is not scripted, by the way. That did just pop into my head. Pete, any other production aspects you'd like to hit about Trust Me?
Not really.
I'll just mention one other. I thought that the fact that they did the title card at the very end, which is, you know, certainly has been done many times before, certainly has been done, I think, more prominently in the last 5 or 10 years. I think that it worked best to do it in this movie, which is to say, you kind of look at, you know, the poster, the preview, and it's saying like, hey, trust me, like almost kind of like the liar, liar, you know, trust me, smile. This was more, we have an unnamed story. Obviously, you know what you're watching. You bought the ticket, you rented it online, you know, but to enter into the fiction of the experience, the fiction of the story, you're watching this unnamed story where ultimately you can trust next to no one. And then what's the slap in the face to say, and fade to the deepest black of all, fade to death, the end, trust me. And it's just to me, that was just one more, I'll use the phrase slap in the face. I don't mean in an offending way. One more, let's say, blow to the heart instead. It's probably a better phrase to just say, oh my goodness, this is not a positive place in which these characters are inhabiting. Well, that, Pete, we've talked about the story, we've talked about the production, and speaking of buying that ticket, etc., let's quickly talk about the model here. This is the first time I have seen a movie on kind of the pre-release digital home circuit. Let me start with this, Pete. A movie like this, it'll be tough to get a ton of screens versus Godzilla and versus the big, you know, big May releases that are still out there and June releases. And next week we're going to have this big movie in 2 weeks from now. So to find a movie like Trust Me, just to find an audience, I think is difficult just out there on the screens competing with the big summer movies. That said, do you find it's a better experience on the big screen? Like, where are you on all this? Is this the future of lower budget movies? What is this here?
That it's available in so many places. And now, you know, the overlap. I mean, I got it through Comcast, and it was saying that it would no longer be available as of the 6th. As of today, I've not checked that it's still there. But, you know, we're losing, we know the filmic experience from, you know, the theater going standpoint has continued to, erode itself. And, you know, ticket prices go up and the experience, you know, from a theater standpoint does not, with very limited, you know, improvement. So to be able to watch it at home, you know, I think that's really appealing, the amount of devices that you can check this out. I mean, just looking at the places where you could either rent or you can own this, not a day and date situation where same day as theaters, you're watching it at home. They're giving you on iTunes, on, you know, Flixster, on Target Ticket, they're giving you that opportunity a month ahead of time to own it. I really do think that is the future of filmmaking.
I agree. I think particularly for this type of film, and I'm of two minds. I mean, it's wonderful to have access in multiple points in my house, you know, the big TV, the computer, the phone, the tablet, the laptop, to have access to this movie so readily. The flip side is I look back over, you know, multiple trips to the movies and some of them having been just absolutely joyous experience with complete strangers. Probably top on that list, you know, the South Park movie where everyone's just laughing so hard that you just hear gasps, you know, for air. And we are all one. And it's this communal experience where I don't think I would be enjoying that movie as much just sitting in my living room by myself. Is that trade-off worth it? I mean, again, it's, you know, for everybody listening to this, you might have a tough time getting to a theater where Trust Me is playing. You should not have a tough time getting to see Trust Me if you want to pay for it. And the fact that the rental is essentially the cost of a movie ticket. At first, I was a little taken aback. It's, oh, I've never paid 10 American dollars to rent a movie. But it's like, sure, I have. Anytime I've gone to the movies, I've paid about $10 to rent the movie. I don't own it. I sit there and I watch it. And then when it's done, it's been disposed of, if you will. I agree. I think this is an interesting and incompletely unknown future, but this is the future we're looking at here. Clark Gregg has delivered us the future with this movie.
And that's going to bring it to more eyes. I mean, let's be honest. There are people who don't go to the theater anymore because of what it is in the year 2014. And let's be honest, it's an overpriced ticket. It's sticky floors. It's disgusting popcorn. And go back and listen to our Captain America, the Winter Soldier podcast. Or read headlines. It's potentially taking your life in your hands.
Yeah, and even if it is a theater where it's not sticky floors and not overpriced popcorn, and you know, maybe the ticket prices are slightly less expensive, there still is that X factor, you know, as you're hinting at, of the annoying person/people behind you, in front of you, around you, you know, which is a takeaway, and we don't have that in this film, so. I guess with that, Pete, any final thoughts overall here for Trust Me?
No, just that I enjoyed it, and I would certainly encourage those who have only seen Clark Gregg through the show, through Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., to get another taste of his many abilities, ably written and directed, and I dare say it will not be the last time we see him write something and direct something.
I absolutely agree. I think that it's worth checking out, even if you're like, well, it sounds a bit dark for me, or it sounds a little Hollywood insidery. This is a movie that is written by Clark Gregg, directed by Clark Gregg, starring Clark Gregg, produced by Clark Gregg. This is somebody who is offering up his own unique artistic vision of a story. That in and of itself is worth supporting and worth checking out. Because none of, you know, as we've said many, many times before, nobody wants another, you know, NCIS, CSI, NYCVU. Like, this is a different and unique take on things, and that is worth supporting, and that is what makes it so interesting to watch. So with that, Pete, why don't we quickly share our contact info? How can people contact you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R.
I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost. You can get in touch with the podcast by tweeting at Fantastic Geek. That's fantastic with a PH. Sending an email to fantasticgeek@gmail.com or leaving a comment on the webpage, fantasticgeek.com. Pete, before we head out, one quick mention to both listeners of our S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast and our pop culture podcast. We will be going to the special edition NYC Comic-Con, which is fast approaching. Pete, what is the date that we will be there?
We will be there on Saturday, June 14th. So would certainly love to catch up with our listeners and our followers. We will be tweeting from the proceedings, and we will be recording a podcast shortly thereafter. So please, if you see us, say hello. If you're following along, you know, let us know. And we hope to provide you with some interesting and entertaining coverage.
Indeed. So, well, Pete, I'm glad that we've been able to get together, have a little chat here about Trust Me. And I guess we will talk to everyone again when we reflect upon Special Edition NYC. So I will say adios to all our listeners, and I will say adios to you as well, Pete.
Trust me.